Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. So bad news. No Scott Braddock. We don't know where he is. But he did send me a couple of interesting talking points that I just want to at least open with, and then we're going to go to an old interview, which isn't that old, with Bill Curry, one of the best talkers I know about the whole issue of healthcare. Anyway, he wanted to talk about the following. With the House Speaker disgraced, as in the Texas House Speaker, GOP power players begin to assess strategy for protecting the Texas House majority. You think they get nervous in Texas? I think so, the Republicans. And how about this one? As protections for young immigrants face Supreme Court scrutiny, Texas business leaders push legislative solutions with Cornyn and Cruz. It's always fascinating when the business community steps up and talks about immigration, because they understand the need for immigration, and we're getting sort of anal and too nationalistic. And then, oh, he's being so harsh. Beto drops out of the presidential 2020 campaign, and his aside, does anyone care? Oh, Scott. And then finally, he wanted to talk about Governor Greg Abbott moves homeless Texans out of sight in Austin. But they still remain homeless. So obviously, he hasn't found a permanent answer for the homeless in Texas. But if you don't see it, you don't talk about it. And then last but not least, he did send me something that he tweeted about that I wanted to share. And he said to me, do you know what Lieutenant Dan Patrick is neurotic about? You know what keeps him up at night? The possibility of Michelle Obama running for president of the United States. Wow, maybe Michelle should run just to keep him up at night. Anyway, those are the things that Scott wanted to talk about, but unfortunately no Scott Braddock. But we're grabbing an older interview with Bill Curry. As I mentioned before, Bill Curry was the two-time Democratic nominee for governor in Connecticut, an advisor to Bill Clinton, a political analyst. He also writes on a regular basis for Salon.com. A couple of weeks ago, I called him up and I said, talk to me about healthcare. And he did an absolutely fabulous, fabulous job talking about this sort of faux fight between those that want to, you know, improve the ACA. And then, of course, Warren and Bernie talking about Medicare for all. You need to hear it. It is an enlightened conversation. It is a progressive conversation. And it, one, it recognizes why the conversation for Medicare for all is important. And there is a way to get there. It, however, may not be a switch. So stick around. This, of course, is going to be the Scott Braddock version, but no Scott Braddock with Bill Curry. That gives me an opportunity to talk to Bill about so many issues that have been pressing on my mind. So one, Bill Curry, thank you for this last-minute reprieve. I appreciate it.
Glad to fill in.
It's
my
great.
Pleasure.
Well, and I couldn't imagine a better fill-in, so let me just say that.
I believe that your other guest has certainly had a tumultuous an emotionally draining week or two, so
well, she,
I understand.
And you know, to some extent, let me just touch on this because we will be talking with more in-depth with Jennifer Horn, who I've known for like 25 or 30 years. She used to be the chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party. She used to be a radio talk show host in Nashua, New Hampshire, where I was a radio talk show host. So trust me, we girls, we know each other. But just before I was going to grab her, I saw that the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans has resigned as well. So they are dropping like flies. And, you know, I'm just trying to figure this out. I understand that, like every group, no group is monolithic. But the Log Cabin Republicans, if this is done because these are rich white men, they could join the business roundtable. You know, I mean, why are they bothering to identify as gay rich white men and then only embrace the rich part and ignore the gay part? It just blows my mind how they're making this decision to endorse Donald Trump. And I would even love to get 5 minutes from you on your thoughts about that. And then we'll go into a heavy lift next week with Jennifer Horn. But this to me seems like they're working against every self-interest if their sexual preference is at all important to them.
Well, it sure does. But of course, let me say if they're rich white gay men, they've actually got two bases covered here.
That's
rich
right.
And white.
Rich and white. That's right. Shut up.
And there's such a strong cultural identification. I've met and spoken with gay Republicans and of course African American Republicans and Hispanic Republicans and many of whom have become indignant at the perceived idea that being gay or black or Hispanic means they can't be a conservative, and of course it doesn't. There are moments when you look at how this administration has handled all those issues that are so critical to their own full citizenship.
Exactly.
And their own full humanity.
Exactly.
That they can do what the rest of, however, what gay, white, straight men have done.
Yeah.
It's just more obvious here. They've alienated their own humanity.
Thank you.
They have walked away from the fullness of citizenship. They've decided to care only about the economy and not about the democracy, and only about the economy as they think it pertains to them. How you get to that point in life, and of course they have an ideology for it. They're not out there consciously abandoning these principles, most of them. They're out, these other principles. They've developed a kind of, you know, libertarian philosophy regarding the economic issues that they profit from. And they've, you know, they believe it. When you talk to them, it's clear that they believe it. We all suffer denial about things. We all know what it means to believe what you want to believe in this life. And the log cabin episode in the last couple of weeks with Trump, it's just that it's all real. It's just etched out in bas relief. You see all these conflicts that so many groups have, and that all of us have in different ways, but that the, you know, that this hardline Republican, modern Republican Party has just, you know, cubed. You just see it all there. They're being specifically repressed in public ways from week to week, and they act as if they're not. And it really, in the end, just kind of breaks your heart.
It is breaking my heart. I look at New Hampshire, and I started, you know, getting very political here in the 1980s. And New Hampshire was a libertarian state. And what I meant by that was that it didn't believe in big government or big church. Okay?
Yeah, there's still a bit of that up there.
Yeah, there's – no. We were the first state that legislatively embraced gay marriage. We didn't have to go through a court to get there. So it was a place that basically said, you know, your body is yours. Your relationships are yours. What you want to do, whether it comes from issues of choice and abortion, whether it's about loving someone that you choose to love, those are things. But then there were these conservative values. They didn't want big government. They didn't like a lot of taxes. They basically sort of believed in the opportunities that corporate America and privatization could bring them. But they could marry the two together. What is just so shocking about what the log cabin Republicans have done is that I know they've made some cash with Donald Trump because of the tax cuts. But when it comes to a lot of the other conservative values, he has none of them. He has none of them. Look at his policy on trade and tariffs. Look at his policy on immigration. Look at his policy. I mean, you can just go through a conga line of things where it comes to things that they would have had on their checklist that they believe, including the idea of supporting, you know, transgender and gender rights and gay rights. And he has really, except for making them some money, he has walked away from every conservative value because it's only a Trump value. And that's a selfish value that has nothing to do with them. You're just lucky if you can figure out a way to dance with him for the moment.
Well, and so, you know, the one thing we know is that anything they ever have to say on issues of gay rights, we can safely discount from here on in.
Yeah.
That anything they have to say about social justice, more broadly speaking, we can safely discount. It's not the business they're in.
They're
in the business of appropriating these issues for other purposes. Not the first time I've seen it. Won't be the last. Here's the really good news, though, and just sort of step back from this for a second. I honestly believe that in 2016, Democrats made the mistake of thinking that demography was going to save them, that there were just so many new voters, Latinos and African-Americans, et cetera, coming in, that it would be almost impossible for them to lose. And for one problem was that they were operating on data that turned out to be very wrong about the composition of the 2012 electorate, and they were extrapolating from that bad set of data. But also they were just ahead of the curve, and it's not just the rise of minority populations as a percentage of the overall electorate. It's also the simple fact that all the people in our generation are beginning to die out, and certainly the generation before us at an even more rapid race. But the boomers, you know, the silent generation are leaving us now, and the boomers are coming right after them.
Right.
This is the song of life. And the younger people who are coming up simply are better on these kinds of issues, markedly better. And so you have the changing racial landscape of the electorate, and you also have the changing age. These new kids coming in, 4.5 million of them per year, 16 million new voters coming in with each four-year cycle, and a smaller number leaving on the other side, passing on. And so I think this is the last time that a Republican Party like this can run a presidential election on these terms. I don't think it's going to work this time. We should take nothing for granted. I'm as sorrowed as anyone to see the country still as evenly split as it is, that 4 out of 10 of my fellow citizens would consider voting for a mentally ill fascist criminal like Donald Trump, self-evident on every count on the public record, also breaks my heart. But this is ending. And the and last thing I just want to say is that New Hampshire party you were talking about, that's the next Republican Party, and it's happening so much faster than the Republicans think. But I believe if we have the right team with the right message, we'll win the Senate, and we'll win the White House in 2020. And in 2024, a homophobic, misogynist, sexist, racist, gun-toting, extreme evangelical party will not be able to win a national election. This is their last walk down the runway.
Well, and you know, so people like Jennifer Horn and Fergus Cullen, these are two former GOP chairmen in the state of New Hampshire. They get it. And one of the reasons I think – they won't say this out loud, but I think one of the reasons why they're desperate for the Democrats to win in 2020 is that it's their way of basically rebuilding a Republican Party from scratch. Because
and that's going to be a very hard thing. But, yeah, I that's absolutely true. And all those sort of John Kasich and Jennifer Horn, the people who are on that task now, I know – you know, everything that's written is about how the Republican Party is in the iron grip of Trump. I get it. I get that this election is a toss-up. As I said, anyone who takes it for granted is a fool. And but I also get that a Republican Party can emerge from this. Yes. I constantly tell my progressive friends that three times as many millennials voted libertarian as voted green.
Yes.
And until we absorb that fact, we're not going to be understanding some of the issues we have to confront in order for us to continue to govern if we do win in 2020. And it's not just for the Democratic Party to think these things through, because the Democratic Party at the top is too itself brain dead and still too corrupted by big money to have this conversation. But progressives have to be capable of examining our own consciences and our own methods and make sure that we look at the legitimate grievances of voters about whether our programs really work, about whether they're as, you know, unobtrusive as possible. We can't just be Hubert Humphrey. The good news is that the more radical the solution, the simpler it is and the more effective it is in almost every case. We just have to make sure that we're the kinds of progressives who are ready not just to write the check, but to change the rules.
Yeah.
You know, that's where...
Well,
that's where I know it's a very broad statement. We don't have time to really delve into it, but that's where the changes come. It doesn't cost you know, and I love the audacity of Bernie's climate change proposal. It doesn't cost $16 trillion. It costs to the government. It costs an immediate change in fuel efficiency standards.
Yes.
An immediate strengthening of the Obama power plant regulations. There are so many rules. An immediate imposition of passive solar design standards into all building codes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many things we can do to reshape this country.
But you know what? We know how to pull the trigger quickly. We do. And I'm going to go back to what happened after the 2008 economic meltdown. I mean, look what we were able to do. We were like, speaking, how big a check? How quickly can we do this? Let's look the other way. I mean, we ignored a lot of things in order to figure out how to address this, because this was such a unique situation that it required a unique, maybe wrong, but it required a unique response. And that leads me to the question that I saw this morning at slate.com that I wanted to bring up with you, because you mentioned the Green New Deal of Bernie Sanders. You mentioned what's happening with the urgency. We're going to be talking on Thursday about the Amazon and what's happening there with another climate denier in charge of a country. But this is the question. Is it criminal that we aren't borrowing trillions to fix the country and save the planet right now? And I am just looking at the fact that we have been able to find, after 9/11, some kind of incredible capacity to respond. We've been able to find, after what happened with the economic meltdown, some incredible capacity to respond. This, which is even more explosive and more damaging and more harmful, it just feels like if you don't do it now, what the hell is wrong with you?
Well, first of all, again, I agree, and there's a huge infrastructure tab here. There's no that which is simply unavoidable, much of which relates to climate change. But you know, I would just say that there's two different models. People, when the stimulus, you know, it was, I think, of mixed use, of mixed effectiveness. There were 18 million homeowners with their mortgages underwater. And we never helped them.
Thank you.
And that's why the real estate market never came back quickly.
Yeah.
We promised to raise the minimum wage substantially, and Obama simply decided not to do it. Because, literally, he thought it would disrupt his relations with the business table, whom he was cultivating the way he was cultivating Republican leaders in Congress, to no real avail. He promised not a mandate, but a public option that would have driven down costs, a real public option that would have driven down costs for small businesses and the self-employed. He didn't deliver. If he'd done a public option, bailed out those 18 million homeowners and raised the minimum wage...
No Donald Trump.
There'd be no Donald Trump.
Right.
Okay? And not one of those would have cost... Because bailing out the homeowners would have paid itself back, as it did during the Depression. None of that would have cost us a penny. And while none of it's even what I would call radical, but all of it was at least some structural change. What you do by rulemaking is far more effective.
Right.
This system, all these big institutions are badly broken.
Right.
And so I think the same thing is here. There is a big cost. The thing about the energy and healthcare sectors, which are, you know, together, well, close to 30% of the entire GDP, they have to be completely changed. We have to get to a Medicare for all. I think we can transition to a public option. I think that's the best way politically, logically.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, we have to get there.
Right.
And we have to get, and I don't mean in the far distant end either. We have to get there in the next few years, and we have to transition to sustainable economics based on conservation, renewable energy. And we have to do those things overnight. But if you look at how much of it we can do by simply facing up to powerful corporate interests and facing them down,
yes,
and changing the inequitable rules by which we now transact all of our business in both those sectors, enormous change can flow.
And you know what's amazing about this? Let me just say something also, because I keep, you know, I listen to people like Andrew Yang, and I listen to all these different presidential candidates about the job future and how it'll change because of robotics. Do you know what the other beauty of addressing climate change and addressing it now with a big bang is? That 90% of those jobs happen here now. They happen here now. You don't outsource, you know, making a house more efficient. You don't outsource putting a solar panel.
When Trump, who just this week is trying to lift methane standards, despite opposition of much of the oil industry, and trying to lift the fuel efficiency standards, despite the opposition of most of the automobile industry, in all of these cases. You have a chance to move forward again in rapidly, without expenditures, without intrusion, without that kind of burdensome, build a huge bureaucracy.
Exactly.
It's not time to be Hubert Humphrey. One of the things about radical change is that it's cheaper. It is more sustainable because it conserves. It is a less exploitive and wasteful way to live in relationship to the planet. And you can see the numbers. If you make the changes, you can see the numbers. And the last thing is that some of this stuff does require some planning. One of the things I liked about Bernie's proposal, by the way, is that he didn't go with the carbon tax. I know that most of my progressive friends really like it. And I would be for a carbon tax. I proposed one and worked on one of the original proposals with the people who were pushing it in the late 1990s. Yeah. If it was modeled on the Alaskan system where all the money goes back to the taxpayers.
Right. British Columbia did that. Exactly that.
Right. But we always promised that. The problem is that when we promised those things, when the government promises things, it often breaks its promise. But that's the one way. But otherwise, I just look at this and I think we can just change all these rules.
Yes.
We change. Rather than repeal them all, as Trump's doing, we should strengthen them.
Yes.
And we can move quickly. And then we decide where to spend the money.
Yes.
We decide, I believe we can go without nuclear. Mm-hmm. I believe that Bernie's also right about that. I don't know whether you can take down all the nuclear plants overnight. You know, that does, you know, it's at some point you are keeping a scorecard here on the money side. But no more nukes and the planned decommissioning of them over time. Absolutely.
So,
you know, carbon tax, nuclear. Yeah. We have to figure out a transportation problem. One of the problems with the Obama stimulus was that he called for what he said were shovel-ready projects.
I remember.
What that meant was the projects that had been all approved already by state departments of public works and transportation, that too often approve projects in a politically biased way due to corruption, that have no good plans of their own. We need to sit down and ask ourselves how much of this country really can be served by train.
Well,
Where will each of these systems work? We haven't done the kind of overall planning. It would be great to see a public and expert discussion both really blossom in this country about what that next energy efficient, sustainable transportation system is going to look like.
So let me just say something. So we have a highway trust fund. Note the word highway trust fund.
Yeah.
That means that all the money that we put into anything, you can't envision rail. You can't envision anything but highways. When you look at how underserved our highways are, you know, if we actually try to fulfill what we are so retarded on right now, we would be on a 30-year plan to start building roads. But that means that 30 years ago, they were shovel ready. We just didn't have the cash. But 30 years ago, the world looked different. The population looked different. How we access and we want to use transportation is different. So we're going to go back to a 30-year model to build today, when what you need to do is look at ahead 30 years to figure out how to anticipate. So everything we are doing is looking to the past as opposed to looking to the future. And given the fact that the future is changing so dramatically, that's another reason why, is it criminal, that question, is it criminal that we're not committing trillions and trillions of dollars to address climate change? Because it is not only the right dollar spent, it is the only thing that will absolutely save us. This is a security issue and an economic issue and an issue that if we actually have a sense of generational ethics, we should have done yesterday.
Let me just say, is it criminal? Which, of course, brings us to the question of David Koch.
Yes, David Koch.
And
his passing.
May he rest in place. May he rest in peace in a place just as warm as the one he left us.
Yes, very good.
I do hesitate to speak ill of the dead, and I don't judge the man in any other way. But what he did is beyond doubt technically criminal. And the people who are criminals here are the Rupert Murdochs and the Kochs, who know better. David Koch, in an interview, once said that he understood that the East Coast and probably both coasts would be underwater.
Yes.
But that would be okay because we would simply move everyone inland.
Yeah.
And he understood there was a possibility that the upper plain states would no longer be able to be as fertile as they are now, but that we would find some kind of technological fix, you know, a technological fix to a planet on fire.
Right.
But when he gave money away, he didn't give money away to people who said, don't worry, you can evacuate the coasts and replace the upper plain states. He gave it away to people who said it wasn't happening.
Yes.
He spent all of his money lying.
Yeah.
And that is, and again, Trump is the most obvious example, obviously, now in the world, and the single most dangerous human to the planet itself, because we are running out of time. But, you know, what these people have done, Rupert Murdoch, the Murdoch company, has all kinds of green energy plans that it has instituted internally.
Mm-hmm.
It knows what's happening.
Of course it does.
It makes money putting people on television who lie. Think of what a cynical, awful, unpatriotic, disloyal, selfish bum Rupert Murdoch must be.
Can I run that as a commercial?
To know what he's doing.
Yes.
And to know that it's a lie, and that so many smart people feel that it's a lie that is catastrophic.
Right. Right.
And to tell it anyway.
Well, you know,
because he doesn't have enough money.
Oh no, but and that is the problem. We do have the financial capacity, and the irony here is that it is about jobs, it is about economic stability. There are so many reasons to do it and do it now, and that is the part. And to somehow think that the private sector is going to somehow embrace it, they are not going to embrace it as long as they're seeing short-term profit gains by not changing. And what we need to do is we need to make it hurt so that short-term profits are not possible. It is only if they change their behavior. Behavior, and if they move forward on that behavior, so we create both the incentives and the investment. You know the story. For every dollar you spend on infrastructure, you stimulate $7 in the private sector. Now the question is, what kind of infrastructure are you investing in order to see the stimulation within the private sector? If it's solar panels, it'll change what happens in the private sector. If it's wind, it'll change what's happening. If it's rail, it'll change what's happening. We have to make those initial infrastructure investments in the right and sound and climate-friendly way, and you will see the private sector flourish. Flourish. Yeah. This is the killer.
But so on our side, we have to do a better job of a couple of things, and one of which is that we have to do a better job of both simplifying and connecting.
Yes.
I don't mean oversimplifying the issue, but when you get to the best possible explanation and the best possible proposal, the complexity simplifies itself.
Yes.
And people can more easily understand. And we have to do a better job of personalizing as well. So, you know, to think, you know, simplify, connect, and personalize. I've been very admiring of Elizabeth Warren because she's the best at that I've seen since Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Clinton wasn't always for the policies I wanted to be before, but he was and still is a master at distilling complex issues into arguments that people can both understand and identify with.
And on that note, Bill Curry, you are a master.
And she's that way. We all have to become more that way.
You are a master of being called at the last minute and providing us with some of the best content I could ever possibly imagine. We adore you. Go to Salon.com. You can see his opinion pieces. He was a former Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton, and he is one of the best political commentators on the planet. Thank you so much for joining us.
Talk to you soon.
All right, Joe.
Bye.
Pulling Phragmites in Georgian Bay on this current cast. Wetlands in Ontario's Georgian Bay are threatened by an invasive grass called Phragmites that outcompetes many native species.
It actually can grow to about 18 feet tall and displace native plants from their aquatic habitat.
That's David Sweetnam of the nonprofit Georgian Bay Forever. He says in some areas, there are hundreds of Phragmites plants per square meter.
You have species that go between the water and the land, like turtles, to lay their eggs. They can't physically get through the stands of Phragmites.
So Sweetnam's group is training volunteers to identify and remove the invasive plants by hand. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at CurrentCast.org.
He thought he was the smartest guy around. Well, I found out last Monday that Bob got locked up Sunday. They've got him in the jailhouse way downtown. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and a-shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now. Howdy, old day, hee-dee-o-tee. whist and euchre, but shooting dice was his favorite game. Well, he got thrown in jail with nobody to go his bail. The judge done said that he refused the fine. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and a-shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. Joining us in studio is Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is a Concord attorney, but Michael, you have so much more to your resume than that. So why don't you give my audience a little bit of the background on who you are, because I think it's important if we're going to be talking about the topic that you wrote about in the Concord Monitor, which is about bail reform. And I think people need to understand that you come to the table with quite a bit of knowledge. So share at least a short bio.
Well, again, thank you, Ernie, for having me on your show. As a critic of law enforcement, I think I'm coming from a strange place in that I used to be part of law enforcement. I was a homicide prosecutor with the New Hampshire Department of Justice for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. I was one of the staff attorneys on both of the capital cases. I tried the State versus Brooks case, and I argued the constitutionality around the capital murder statute, mm-hmm. both in Brooks and in the Addison case. And I have a tremendous amount of affection for and respect for law enforcement. And I've worked with police officers both in the state police and in departments all over the state. I understand the risks they face, which are substantial. I don't think many people really truly understand how difficult it is to be a police officer. Mm-hmm. For me to write an article that raises concerns about positions that are being taken by law enforcement in the area of policy may seem a little sideways for people. Mm-hmm. But I have to do so because I have a greater commitment to public safety than just choosing teams, picking sides, and saying, well, this is where I stand.
And I want to stop you there because I want people to hear what you just said, because what's really important is it's an issue of public safety.
Yes.
So people have a knee-jerk response sometimes when they hear about bail reform that you're talking about perhaps making us less safe, but you're stepping back, looking at both sides, having an understanding of the whole sort of question and saying, in the end, how do I make sure the public is as safe as it can be? And these may be the ways that we can reform the system.
Yes.
Okay.
And also understanding that policymakers have, limited time, we have limited resources to solve issues, it's very important to me that when we focus on issues, we're focusing on the right ones and not the marginal ones and not ones that are meant to elicit emotion as opposed to reason when it comes to keeping people safe.
So can we start with the definition of terms? Because I think a lot of people, you come from a place where you understand the whole picture to some extent, the gestalt, but a lot of people don't know. They may have heard of bail. They don't know what bail is. They don't know sort of the history of bail, what the purpose of bail is. So if we're going to be talking about bail reform, I think we need to understand what the raison d'etre was for bail.
Well, first, I think you want to start with the presumption of innocence.
Good point.
So, and it's something that prosecutors and I know I did take very seriously. That is to say that any American, any person who enters our court system is presumed innocent and must be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And what's important about that is that it ties our system and the extent to which it interferes with people's liberties in the most serious ways to a process that requires the production of evidence. Mm-hmm. That is, and the evidence must pertain to what the law says is prohibited as a matter of conduct.
Right.
And so that's where you have to start. Bail is an early part of the process of public justice and public safety. So if a person is arrested for a crime,
okay.
Right, they are in the system, the police will have probable cause to prove up the databases for obtaining a warrant under the Fourth Amendment and the state constitution. And so there's evidence that's been presented to a tribunal, a judge, and that evidence justifies the police in interfering in someone's liberty. But what do you do when you've made an arrest and you know that someone who you've proven, at least at a probable cause standard, has committed a crime, won't be tried for a number of months, if not a year, if not more, in terms of protecting public safety?
And yeah, but is it that long before
possibly.
That possibly? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not in all cases, but you know, like in big cases,
yeah.
in murder cases,
yeah.
in
yeah.
cases involving deaths,
of course,
it
because
could be
I have
that
to,
long.
They have to collect the information that yeah, you're right.
right.
Okay, okay.
But you know, but we're talking a matter of months.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, this is a major problem that bail reformers and you know think about. But what do you do in that intervening period of time? Well, to protect the public. And also to, you know, to ensure that someone's right to be deemed innocent until proven guilty to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt is respected, we've had for a long time a system called the bail system. Mm-hmm. And the bail system is, you know, is essentially a series of orders that are entered that a defendant facing a criminal charge must abide by,
mm-hmm.
and is subject to supervision in regard to, in order to keep the public safe and to ensure that the law is respected. That's what bail is. So there, it's an order, and the judge will say. So, for instance, in a domestic violence arrest, mm-hmm. which is a very serious and troubling crime, mm-hmm. where you have inequality of power, typically between men and women,
mm-hmm.
and you need. You know, the system to intervene to protect women often from violence, the judge will enter no contact orders as part of a bail condition.
Bail isn't just monetary?
It's not just monetary.
Okay. See, that I didn't know that.
No.
Okay, good. Okay, this is an important – that's no. why I'm glad we're defining terms. So bail is it's a bigger list of
right.
things that have to be done, and it isn't just about money.
Yeah. Bail,
gotcha.
Bail should be a judicial order.
Gotcha.
And, you know, it's – one of the things that, you know, I bang my head against the wall about constantly is the need to pay attention to the connection between staffing our judiciary and public safety and public health.
Right.
Because this is an important moment
right.
In our public safety apparatus where yeah. judges have to be involved, both at the warrant phase and at the bail setting phase. They have to be people of quality
mm-hmm.
and they have to be available to assist,
yeah.
you know, us in making sure that we have the correct orders in place that will keep us safe while balancing liberty interests.
So let me ask a quick question, Michael. So as the judge is going to be ordering bail, how much information does the judge need to make an informed decision about the kind of bail he should be demanding of the individual standing in front of him? Because again, as you said, it could take a year for this to actually happen. It could take a couple of months. Obviously, the police are collecting this information. They had enough information for a warrant, right. but that's not the same as bail.
Right. So, I mean, typically, and this is these are the traditional standards that the judge has to look to in determining how to set bail.
Okay.
And this is another way of answering your question.
Okay.
The judge is seeking to ensure the public safety.
Absolutely.
Right? So the judge is going to look at the dangerousness of the
mm-hmm.
defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge is also looking to ensure the defendant will appear in court in the future and be subject to the process that I've just described, which
mm-hmm.
is proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge also has a generalized desire to ensure that someone who's been arrested for a crime complies with the laws of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all good goals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think probably first and foremost in people's minds is the first goal, which is to ensure that someone who's been arrested for a crime is subject to orders that will mitigate and lessen the dangerousness they pose to society generally. There are a number of ways to prove that. And the rights that pertain to the process are not the same as the rights that exist inside the trial system. So there's not a generalized right of cross-examination. Mm-hmm. There's not a generalized right of compulsory process where you, mm-hmm. you know, where you can demand that the, you know, people testify. Cases can be established by proffer. That is, an attorney or police officer can stand up and give an offer of proof to the court. They can do so if they can provide some witness who can back up the testimony. Mm-hmm. And in our state, that can be a police officer who has interviewed and collected evidence and can describe that evidence to the judge. And that evidence can be described in the form of hearsay, which is not normally allowed mm-hmm. in a trial, but is allowed at this preliminary stage. Mm-hmm. And that police officer will be subject to cross-examination. Mm-hmm. But the witnesses who provided the information in the first instance do not have to be, mm-hmm. right? So – but it's going to have to come from either an attorney who is, you know, licensed to practice law and subject to ethical constraints, or a police officer under oath. You know, that is a diminished but nevertheless important stage in which evidence is presented in some form to a judge.
So let me just ask a quick question, because as I'm thinking about all the orders are going to come through and, and a lot of this, to some extent, I think also is what's driving you is the monetary aspect of it.
Right.
But one of my concerns here is that do you actually need bail reform or do you need judicial reform?
I mean,
do you need to right. do you need to like teach judges about how they should decide about bail, as in from the monetary perspective, or do you actually need to write legislation that requires bail reform that's written in law? To me, it sounds like you're really asking a judge to make an informed decision, and that informed decision shouldn't be that you should lean on cash as part of your bail request, that you should look at the whole picture, and that monetary needs to be looked at in a very sensitive way, in part because there's a real difference between a wealthy individual and a poor person. And it's not a guilt question. It's a wealth question. And that should not be a dictate as to whether you say, okay, $10,000 for you, because for a wealthy guy, $10,000 is 2 cents. For a poor guy, he's in jail. I mean, it's just no question.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that I think is really important, and it kind of goes back to what I said in the first part of when we were talking about why I'm talking about this, is when we talk about criminal justice reform generally, it's important to be accurate or as accurate as possible about causation.
Yeah.
Right? And so if – you know, one of the things that people who oppose bail reform will do is they will Willie Hortonize every discussion.
Yes.
So, you know, you will get press releases – where you have people who have been arrested 100 times and been released by a judge, have been released by a judge, mm-hmm. and that press release will be offered as proof that we need to be harsher in the bail context, because a loose bail order is to blame for this person being on the street over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy it. I mean, I think that the problem, if the press release accurately describes someone being arrested over 100 times,
mm-hmm.
is not with the bail statute. It's with the failure of prosecutors and police to present that as persuasive evidence regarding the setting of conditions of bail.
Exactly.
And for that, because someone who is violating the law constantly, has tons of convictions,
yeah.
you know, particularly for violent crimes,
yeah.
that person probably should be incarcerated pre-trial,
exactly.
right? Because the person is dangerous.
Right.
And the idea that, you know, that a judge – if a judge is properly being presented with evidence
yeah.
That describes fairly – that set of circumstances, there is nothing about the reform bail statute
that will change
that will prevent the judge
yeah.
from imposing very harsh bail conditions that, if not complied with, would result in ultimately, if not immediately, the incarceration of a person pending trial.
So as you heard me say, I thought bail was always monetary, and you're telling me no, it's not. It's much bigger than that. So tell me, as you look at bail reform, and I'm assuming that you're looking at bail reform not just as a way to educate judges, but also as a way to put something into black letter law, What are you looking for? What are the parameters of bail reform that will give perhaps more guidance to a judge, more guidance to the police that normally are bringing that defendant before the judge? So I'm kind of curious, what does it look like if right now I'm hearing that the judge has tremendous latitude to make certain decisions? And it sounds like it's a judge that needs to be enlightened, not necessarily a system that needs to be put into law.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think fundamentally the judges, and I'm sure many of them do, and the police need to read and understand the law.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they need to understand that there's nothing about the law that prevents them from demanding from police and prosecutors that they supply evidence to meet the burdens of proof that they must meet to, you know, to hold someone, you know, to strict bail conditions and even pretrial incarceration. So, for instance, the current law says – there's nothing about the current law that says if a police officer or a prosecutor presents evidence that an arrested defendant is dangerous, mm-hmm. that arrested defendant shouldn't be incarcerated pretrial.
Right.
You know? So like someone who has a long history of – breaking and entering or assault or, right. you know, aggravated felonious sexual assault. I mean, that person may not be safe on the streets pending trial.
Right.
And it is fair under our laws to interfere with that person's liberty. It is fair.
So we're in a rut. So I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking that a lot of people are concerned about the fact that it has a greater impact on poor and
yes.
low-income individuals. So what I'm thinking is it just easier to say write a check than to demand of the police or to spend the time to ask all the questions that should be asked? So the kind of bail you're demanding is something that's both reasonable, rational, based on whatever documentation you're being given at the time, and will still make sure that there are some constraints on that individual, but those constraints monetary, because monetary constraints usually mean if you can't come up with the cash, you're going to jail.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
Like so here's an example. Like the many of the examples of recidivism.
Yep.
I mean, if you have a person who's arrested 100 times. Mm-hmm. You know, that press release went out from the Manchester Police Department. The vast majority of those arrests occurred under the prior bail statute, which was harsher. And so you would expect the police to be as critical of, you know, the unreformed bail laws as they would be of the current bail laws.
So wait a minute. Okay. So what are you saying? So under the old bail laws, they were arrested 100 times and let out.
Right.
So it's not like the new ones are going to be a greater threat.
So I mean, what you'd argue is that you made this point, which
yeah.
is that, you know, that looking at money as the easy way out of like covering, of CYAing
yeah.
a bail situation does not keep people safe. All right.
So I'm going to give an analogy, and you're going to hate me for this, but you know
okay.
me, I'm a lefty. And as a progressive, what I always say is that when banks get fined and people think that stops their behavior,
right.
the fine doesn't stop the behavior. They've actually written it into the cost of doing business. So people say, oh, look at this. They just spent, you know, $500 million. And I'm going, no, they make that in 2 weeks. So the problem is that you need to be both sensitive to what the fine is or the bail is, in this case, the monetary bail, and also the individual you have in front of you. And you need to make sure that there's a cause and effect.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing that you've said that I disagree with.
Okay.
So bail is, in fact, an incentive-based system
yeah.
that imposes costs on people. And those costs are meant to curb behavior in the aftermath of an arrest.
Right.
And some costs will be sufficient, some won't. Some will be justified, some won't. So for instance, I mean, there will be very, very rich defendants, and I prosecuted some of them, right?
I know.
And they are very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
They will very easily be able to make bail.
Yeah.
Whereas you have far less dangerous defendants who will never be able to pay a fraction
right.
of the same price And they will not make bail, and they'll stay in jail and maybe even be acquitted.
So what do we need to be concerned about this? Is it that because there is such a long time between the arrest and the actual trial, and when you look at someone who now can't make bail in the sense of the financial bail, and because of that financial constraint, they may not be dangerous, but what you've now done is taken away their freedom, and that has a greater impact on that individual, their families, everything else. We still presume that they're innocent. So during this innocent period, they can't work, they can't take care of their kids, they're in jail, they're not bringing in an income. I mean, understand that what is so complicated.
They may be mentally ill.
Oh, my
God. They may
God.
Be in jail. I mean,
exactly.
You know, so I will tell you, I did a guardianship case mm-hmm. in which, you know, a person engaged in a violent crime. Mm-hmm. The person was deteriorating mm-hmm. By virtue of not taking medicine.
Right.
Needed guardianship. And, you know, when the person was arrested, he/she was in, you know, a jail, which doesn't have a very sufficient mental health provider mm-hmm. Reputation.
Right.
And in the course of the case about guardianship, people from the mental health community came in and testified that our mental health system was broken. And as a result, you know, this guy was not being monitored sufficiently by assigned mental health providers, and that a guardianship was necessary as a least restrictive means to right. ensure that he would be healthy and safe, and the community would as well.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, what I've just described is another variant of the problem of not being very careful about individuals, their plight, and how, you know, they ended up, you know, interfacing with the law enforcement and in pretrial.
So this still seems to me very judgmental. I mean, it's not math in the sense that, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. It requires an informed yep. judge. It requires informed police. The police are obviously pushing against this. So the bail reform that you are supporting, is it something that we've seen in other states? Do we have the empirical data to show that it hasn't done what a lot of these cops are afraid it might do? And that, in fact, it also recognizes that their goal is safety, security, justice, and the presumption of innocence.
Yes.
Okay. And what are we asking, and where can we look for states that have done it effectively, and we can actually provide ourselves with the empirical data we need? Because we also have to go to the public and say, this is about your safety, but this is also recognizing that things need to change.
Right. I mean, you know, the bail practices inside the federal system, for instance, are very different from the bail practices in New Hampshire.
Hmm.
So, I mean, and this is a product in part of, you know, of a major project that was initiated by Robert Kennedy in the 1960s.
Wow.
Bail reform was a major initiative for Attorney General Kennedy when he entered the Justice Department and took over in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, and I was a federal law clerk, so I mean I used to see this, and I know this because I know assistant AUSAs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know AUSAs, and I mean the bail practices in the federal system tend not to result in pretrial incarceration.
Wow.
And they tend not to, nevertheless, there's no evidence of mass chaos by virtue
exactly,
of that.
Exactly.
You know? And so, you know, and there are dangerous people who get arrested and prosecuted.
Right.
And, you know, and they, you know, they end up having reasonable bail conditions and, you know, and not reoffending. So there's a ton of, and if you impose bail conditions that address dangerousness through the imposition of, for instance, mental health services for some people, drug addiction treatment for some people, I'm not sure how you could argue that those services are somehow less effective than what, you know, county jails can offer in lots of cases.
So before I let you go, Michael, I know that a number of police chiefs don't like this. What is it that they want?
So first I should say, I have an incredible amount of sympathy with police chiefs. And I think what they want is to be able to tell the public and their constituent communities that they're keeping them safe.
Yes, of course.
What they're terrified about is not doing their jobs and something awful happening to people they're supposed to protect. And I share their view. But what I would say to them is, focus on making sure that you can pay your police officers properly. focus on reforming our county system of prosecution. Make sure we have, you know, a trained up, resource series of attorneys handling your cases in court, and focus on the judiciary.
Yes,
you need to have
exactly.
You need to have judges.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And Governor Sununu is refusing to appoint them.
Right.
Right. In his temper tantrum way.
Yeah.
But you need to have judges who are there to do domestic violence orders,
right.
To do bail orders,
right.
To oversee criminal prosecutions in a speedy way,
right.
So that people's rights are protected and we're kept safe.
Right.
And that is not happening. And what I would say to the police is, it's time to identify the right cause here, you know, and to fight for your communities and for the people you're supposed to protect, right. And not to focus us on distractions like bail reform.
On that note, there was a column in the Concord Monitor. It was entitled, "My Turn, Questions a Free People, should pose to opponents of bail reform." Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate your time. And inform me, bail is more than cash. I didn't know that. All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll see you next week. You may-